Hello and welcome to Sideburns, part of the Third Degree Burn podcast family. I'm John Hyatt and with me is Nigel Spink. And in this episode, we are bringing our second episode of the season two of X-Men Hidden Years. And we'll be covering issues 13 and 14. Hi, Nigel.
Hi, John. Good to be here again.
Yeah, especially we're recording this a couple weeks after we actually got to meet in person.
Yes, that's right. It was great meeting all you guys. Yep.
Yeah, we got together for the 10th anniversary of Third Degree Burn podcast, and there'll be a couple of other episodes going on about us kind of talking together and talking about the anniversary stuff we got to do. Some of the great things we got to do was go to some of the great comic book shops in Fort Worth, Texas. What'd you think of them, Nigel?
I really enjoyed that, going around all the comic book shops, because it's been a while since I've been in what you call a real comic book shop. So I was really looking forward to that. Yeah,
and then there was a lot of them. There were just so many for us to go to. Like, we went to two or three a day.
Yes. Yeah. I was surprised. Yeah. How many there were. Well, I'd seen the map before, so I could see there were quite a few in that area. And they were so different. There were, some of them were kind of small, compact little shops that perhaps sold comics as a side line with other things, you know, like collectibles and what have you, games and things, statues. And then there were others which were just like, yeah, massive comic book shops, which was incredible. It was like Aladdin's cave.
Filing cabinets.
Just tons of cabinets going on and on. Unbelievable. Yeah. And so
you got to find a lot of back issues you were looking for, didn't you?
I did. I pretty much got just about everything on my list, which I didn't expect to find. And I picked up one or two other things as well that wasn't on my list. But, you know, as I came across them, I thought, oh, well, yeah, I'll have this, you know, if the price was right. Yeah. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the comic hunting.
That's great. And then you got to go to Fan Expo.
And then we went to Fan Expo, on the final day of my trip. And, and that's where I picked up, I had two or three that I really wanted to get. And going into that final day, I'd still not actually got those three. I'd got most of the other stuff, but I was still after the most wanted, if you like. But I got them at the Fan Expo, so everything turned out well in the end, yeah. There was just one that I couldn't get, but Brian came to the rescue because he said, well, I think I might have got more than one copy of that at home. So when we got back, he had a look, and sure enough, he had two copies of it. So he gave me one of them, which was very nice.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah. What did you think of the expo itself? Was it bigger than you'd expected? Is it a larger convention that you've ever been to, or how does that compare?
It's probably bigger than any other convention that I've been to. I kind of expected it to be, you know, as large as it was. There were lots of things to look at, as well as the comics, you know. So it was a good day just experiencing all that.
Yeah, a lot of costuming as well.
And cosplay people. And never really got to see the other part of it, which was with the guests, where the guests were. We never really went in there. So, yeah, it was quite a big event, yeah.
Well, it was great to meet you in person, and I'm glad that you made it all the way out just for us. That was really cool.
And I enjoyed it. It was a good experience.
Yeah, it was also fun to just be able to chat about comics and sci-fi and movies and things that we liked. So that was...
That's right, yeah.
And then Brian was a great host. He let us stay with him and his family, and they were fantastic. Thanks to his lovely wife, Beth, and Chris for putting up putting us up and with us, up with us.
Yeah.
No, it was just a really amazing time. And then when Tim came out, it was great to see him. I missed seeing Tim's wife because I had to leave early. I didn't get to go to Fan Expo, but
yeah,
it was great to see, get to be in person so the whole crew could be there.
Yeah. I met Tim's wife on the final day at the expo. Yeah.
A lot of fun. So check out some of the other shows that we'll be releasing or have been released, depending on what order they come out. Because we did have a fun day of doing a wrap up kind of thing, chit-chatting about our experiences. So that'll be kind of fun to relive that again.
And there's also going to be another special story time coming up, I believe.
Super duper. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Nigel, we are back into the swing of things with X-Men Hidden Years, and we've crossed the first 12 issues, and last episode was our big double-sized 12th issue, and that was really fun. And so now we're doing X-Men Hidden Years 13 and 14, and I think you're doing bringing us in with 13, right?
That is correct, yes. I have the first of the two issues, so shall we get into it?
Yes, that's...
Right, okay. So, we are going to be looking, as you say, at X-Men The Hidden Years, and I'm going to start with issue number 13, which had a release date of the 4th of October 2000 and carried a cover date of December 2000. But before I get into the other details about that, just to cover, as we do, other works available by John Byrne during that month, which is December 2000. There we had Marvel The Lost Generation number 3. He was the co-writer and penciler on that one. Spider-Woman number 18. He was the writer of that, and I believe that was the last issue of that title. And also, I got something here called X-Men Universe, number 13. And it took me a while to find out what Byrne's connection in that was, actually. When I first looked into it, I thought, well, Byrne's not mentioned here at all.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
But then I realized, well, I found it, yeah. Also in that issue, there was more than like one story, and there is a reprint of X-Men The Hidden Years number 9.
Oh, okay.
Which is one of the ones we've covered previously. So, of course, that's why it had the Byrne connection. Yeah, reprinted Hidden Years number 9.
Okay, cool.
Okay, and then, of course, this issue, X-Men Hidden Years 13, and the usual crew for this issue was writer-penciler John Byrne, the inker Tom Palmer, colorist Greg Wright, letterer John Byrne, editor Jason Liebig, and editor-in-chief, of course, Bob Harris. And the title of this issue, which kind of gives us a hint of John Byrne's love for Star Trek, the original series, the title of this issue is Blood and Circuses, which was also the title of a Star Trek.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Star Trek original series episode, yes. Yeah. Right, so the synopsis goes as follows. A plush bedroom. Cyclops wakes up Marvel Girl, Jean Grey, and proceeds to try and seduce her. But all is not what it seems. Mastermind is playing perverse mind games on Jean at the order of the Blob, who gets angry when Jean does not fall for it. Mastermind explains that the ruse would not work, and the two evil mutants argue. In Dunphy, Illinois, Professor X tries to calm down 10-year-old Ashley Martin, who has just ripped apart a sentinel with her mutant powers. She is now angry with Xavier and Hank McCoy, using her power to psychokinetically put the sentinel back together. Meanwhile, in the Savage Land, Havoc, Lorna Dane and Bobby Drake, Iceman, have found the X-Men's crashed sentinel airship. Bobby skillfully gets the vehicle started and airborne again. Havoc and Lorna head back to their flyer, and the two crafts leave the Savage Land. Back at the evil mutant's lair, Cyclops, Angel, and Candy Southern find themselves captives of the Blob, Eunice, and Mastermind. Angel explains what happened to him and Avia when they were separated from the team. See X-Men Hidden Years number 6. He's surprised to see Candy dressed in one of Marvel Girl's costumes. The Blob and Eunice appear and lead Cyclops, Angel, and Candy into a circus arena where they must fight not only the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, but also wild animals and scary clowns. To make things worse, the X-Men's powers seem to have deserted them. Cyclops' eye beams do not fire, and Angel is unable to take off and fly. This puts them at the mercy of their attackers, who it seems will trash them. However, when Cyclops is about to be stomped by the Blob, he discovers that the arena and most of the animals and clowns are merely an illusion cast by Mastermind, and he orders the others to act accordingly. Switch to Dunphy, Illinois once more, where Ashley Martin is rebuilding her Sentinel to no doubt attack Professor X and the Beast. Xavier sees he has no other option but to telepathically separate Ashley's conscious from the mutated part of her brain. This carries a high risk for the girl, but Professor X seems to be successful, albeit at what cost? Returning to the circus arena, Cyclops and Angel are now fighting back against the villains, though they are still wary due to the illusions of Mastermind. Somewhere nearby, Jean is escaping her cell, but she runs directly into Stefan Kruger, remember him, who immediately shuts her down. At the same time, Iceman, Havoc, and Lorna Dane arrive back at Xavier's school for gifted youngsters. Iceman is worried to see scorch marks on the ground, and also there are no X-Men present. See X-Men Hidden Years number 7. Cerebro has registered a powerful mutant signal in the Himalayas. Finally, in Centerpoint, Long Island, Catherine Worthington is talking to her brother-in-law, Bertram Worthington, about their upcoming wedding. To be continued. And that concludes that issue 13. So, plenty happening in different places here.
Yeah, definitely so.
And so, what did you think of that?
Well, I was glad to start. Well, I'm ready for it to end this multi-story thing. I'm really ready to kind of condense it down to one or two stories instead of three or four.
Right.
There was a lot going on and a lot of action. So
yeah, it's still all happening at the moment.
Yeah. It's like the last four or five issues have all taken place in the span of a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there's a lot going on, as we say, in the different places. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with a quick review by looking at the cover.
Okay. Great cover.
And it's a nice cover. Yeah. I really like this with a rather angry and man on a mission type looking angel flying straight at us. Yeah.
Yeah,
as we kind of look down on them from the sky, so angels coming up at us.
I love this cover, especially with the focus on Angel, because I don't think he sometimes doesn't get a lot of good solo cover shots.
Right. Yeah.
So this was really nice, and this is my favorite costume of his, the blue and white one that he picked up in the Savage Land under Magneto.
Yeah.
So I didn't like it when he switched it to red when he went to visit when he joined the Champions, and that was kind of what they kept him in afterwards. But the blue one, I think, is the best.
Yeah, it does look good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably more, it's in keeping with some of the other costumes. I think that's why it's with the blue. You've got Cyclops with the blue and Beast.
Yeah.
Was wearing blue. Yeah. So it seemed to seem to fit in and match.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Yeah. And you liked it too, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good costume. Yeah. Although I liked it in red as well.
Oh, I meant the cover.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The whole cover. It's very good. Yeah. Yeah. As I say, as well as that, you've got the other three members, Cyclops and Marvel Girl and Candy, dressed as Marvel Girl, looking up, following where Angel is going. It's just a nice picture. It would make me pick it up off the rack, definitely.
And that's all it intends to do, because it's really not a thing we see in the issue.
No, not exactly. Although it does hint at circuses.
Yes.
With those, you can see those kind of like,
oh yeah,
carriages.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the tent behind him.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, did you find the hidden number?
I did. It took me a little bit, but it wasn't as hidden as some of the ones we've mm-hmm. been searching for. It did take me a little bit, but I did find it. Yeah, it's underneath the cabbage under Angel's left arm.
Yeah, that's right. Or as I would have put it, just above the head of Marvel Girl.
That too. Yeah.
On the floor. Yeah.
On the ground there.
Above Marvel Girl. Mm-hmm. That Jean, that is, not Candy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could call Candy Marvel Girl 2, maybe. Marvel Girl 2.0.
Yeah. But there it is. Yeah. It's fairly easy. Once you spot it, you can't miss mm-hmm. it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So number 79, as it would have been.
Mm. Yeah, great issue. Great cover. I like this cover.
And then when I first opened it up, I've not looked inside this one for a while, and I didn't remember that first page, and I thought, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because I don't know what I expected to see. I thought it started with the Sentinel business, you know, with Ashley. But yeah, I'd forgotten about this. It's Mastermind's illusion, and he's pretending to be Cyclops, and he's just trying to get a bit pervy with Jean here.
I think Blob was the one who was trying to get pervy.
Well,
the illusion was cast over the Blob.
Yeah, he was doing it for the Blob. That's true. So Cyclops is the Blob. Yeah, here. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why he's talking that way, yeah. which is what alerts Jean to the fact that this is not Cyclops. Yeah.
Plus, I'm sure when she touched him, she could feel that doesn't.
Yeah, that's not Cyclops.
That's definitely not Slim Summers there.
Yeah, yeah. But I found that interesting because, of course. And then it switches to the real scene over the next page.
Yeah.
And you see that they're really in a small cabin-like room. Yeah, and Jean's their prisoner. But Mastermind alludes to the fact that, you know, the illusion was never going to work much, especially with a telepath, which she is. But that makes you think then about, you know, it obviously gave him the idea, which he then used later as Jason Wingard with the Hellfire Club to try and actually seduce Jean, because he would have.
He does. John Byrne does allude to that definitely here.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially with the quote from Mastermind, where he says it would take a long-term strategy to create in her mind an illusion she wouldn't be able to pierce.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's Byrne retroactively setting up.
Yeah. Yeah,
the work with the Hellfire Club. Now, whether he got this idea then, or it came about when he started trying to win a favor with the Hellfire Club, but still, Byrne is retroactively going back and kind of setting some backstory.
Yeah,
to that.
Very clever for it to fit in with what would be the future.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice how he's weaving things in.
Yep.
And not necessarily retconning things, you know, he's just weaving things in and, you know, here's a possibility. So that was a nice little touch there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a skill that a lot of the writers don't have, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I like their little squabble and Jean's just thinking, pitiful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no wonder our dream of utopian is always so elusive. We can't even, you know, keep peace with ourselves, kind of thing. So
yeah, they're all infighting between the mutants. Yeah.
Yep. Then we're back in Deerfield.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of pages here and then back for a couple more pages.
So Ashley's resurrecting the Sentinel that she's just trashed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, obviously too, because she's getting a bit annoyed with Professor X.
Yes, indeed she is.
And so they might have a problem there as the Sentinel is being rebuilt.
Yeah, it was to me, it was the rebuilding of the Sentinel was a really great panel there. How he's just kind of standing up and then how he's just putting himself back together. Or
Yeah, he's still like not completely rebuilt, but the animation's coming back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And then we're off to the Savage Land again.
Yeah.
Just to see. Yeah. Oh, they find the Sentinel craft that they crashed in back in, what was it, issue 2, 3, 4,
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, keeping the connections going, the continuity. And of course, Iceman, Bobby does a good little trick here, getting that ship going so quickly.
Yeah, I didn't realize, I don't remember at this stage of Bobby's journey that he was that technically minded.
Mm.
You know, he was always goofing around and you know, being the clown. Mm. I don't recall the early, you know, the original run that showed him with any interest in technology or skills of flying or anything. Do you?
Yeah, no, I don't think there was anything there. Yeah. But obviously Bernie's thinking, well, during the, shall we call it, the downtime of what we don't see of the X-Men, they must have, kind of looked over this ship.
Which is good. I mean,
and it also connects in a way to that first 10-page prologue, which was in the X-Men Volume 2 issue, because that centered around the Sentinel craft as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd obviously been checking it over then. And so I guess they learned the basics of how to get it working and what have you during the downtime. And I guess they all learned basically how to turn it on and turn it off and how to get it back working after an emergency or something like that.
Well, very handy and very wise.
Yeah, and he'd remembered that, which of course Havok and Polaris were probably not familiar with because they came in afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. But anyway, good trick there, and he got it all going, and then they finally leave the Savage Land. Yeah,
finally. Yay. And then we're back to the circus,
mm-hmm,
with Cyclops, Angel, and Marvel Girl 2.0. Andy, caged up. Until Eunice shows up. Well, then they show up with supposedly Marvel Girl.
Mm.
I imagine that, well, no, that is definitely an illusion.
That must be, yeah.
As we learn later.
That must be Mastermind's illusion as well. Yeah. Yeah. And the next minute they're in the arena.
Yeah.
Surrounded by animals and clowns, creepy clowns. And there's also an audience watching.
Audience, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't know whether that's real or an illusion. At this point, I thought this was also an illusion.
Yeah, I believe it all is.
Mm.
As we find out later on, they're still just in a very small tent.
True.
With just the few people that are there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's all illusion.
It's all an illusion. On the page, there's no numbers on the actual issue.
No, there are no page numbers.
On the page where the elephants are charging at them,
yep,
on the second panel, you see the figure of Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like he's kind of laid on the floor, but I don't think he is. He's meant to be running out of the way, yeah. But somehow, yeah, the way he drawn that, it didn't work.
Yeah, or else he's doing a somersault,
Yeah, he looks too flat. Yeah. It looks like he's laid down. Yeah.
That's not a very good.
that wasn't the greatest of images there. Because I mean, Angel and Candy at the other side, that looks more kind of 3D-ish. You can get the idea that they're running away. But Cyclops looks flat.
Yeah, he definitely looks like he got steamrolled. And then we continue on to just a pretty much a battle after battle.
They're in there and the animals are attacking and their powers are not working, which is not good.
Yeah.
Nothing they seem to try is working and the blob's giving Cyclops a bad time.
Eunice decided to show up.
Yeah, he throws him up against Eunice's untouchable force field, so he bounces him off him like a wall. Yeah, and then he's going to crush his head.
Yeah, that was pretty intense there. That could be quite a terrible situation.
But of course, that's when Cyclops realizes, there's something funny going on here, and he believes that he's fired his beam, even though it didn't seem to work.
Yeah, it was interesting how he has all time to think and figure this out. I'd be like, geez, get off of me.
Yeah. Another thing is he perhaps when he was on the ground and Blob's foot was on his head, he probably thought, well, this is funny because it perhaps didn't feel like somebody's big foot crushing down on your head. And that's when he thought, there's something not right here. Yeah, and then he obviously fired his beam, but he didn't see it because it doesn't seem to be working. But then all of a sudden he realizes he can lift his head.
Yeah, and then...
Then he realizes,
And we find out on the next page, there's
Blob
in a crater.
Yeah, he did fire his beam and it creates, this hole which Blob fell into.
So that dispels, of course, he lets Warren know that...
Yeah, so then the jig is up. Yeah. And so Warren takes off to the air with Candy.
But that doesn't dispel all of the illusions.
No, so
they're still fighting.
Yeah, and there's some nasty, creepy clowns attacking.
Yes, there are. If you're afraid of clowns, this is not a book to read.
Yeah, this is a creepy one if you don't like clowns. Yeah. And so the battle continues, but it's back to... Dumphy, Illinois, where the Sentinel's building himself up. So the professor decides he's got to do something drastic to stop Ashley.
And that panel on the bottom where it's like, do you? She's quite menacing there.
Yeah, she's got the red eyes. And
Dark
she's
Ashley.
Lost. Yeah, definitely. So the professor takes a risk and goes inside her brain.
Yeah. Her mother is upset, of course. She's not sure what's going on. And he basically psychically disconnects her brain from her powers. Kind of what they did in that bizarre adventure story where he did that to Jean as a little girl.
Right.
What do you think about them doing that to this little girl? And to Jean. And it's also what Reed did to Franklin by shutting down his powers.
Yeah. I've never really thought about it other than on the surface of what is actually happening, she's appearing as a threat right now. And, as Professor X has the ability to do this kind of thing, he's using it, to defuse the danger, if you like. So he does it. Yeah. I've never thought of it in the way, I guess some people think that this is kind of like an incursion into somebody's soul or whatever that shouldn't be done. I don't know, but.
Well, think about it from in the scene of the comics. Think about it from the quote on from Trask, who thinks that, you know what? Mutants are the threat. We should disable them either by making them wear inhibitor collars to inhibit their powers, or surgically you know, amputating their powers somehow, or if all else fails, sending a sentinel after them. Is it kind of the same thing for Professor X to do that to her just because he perceived her as a threat?
I think it's different here because, as I said, Professor X is in danger of being killed even. Mm-hmm. And with his power being mental, he might not be able to do anything against the Sentinel if it gets going, you know.
Yeah.
He could be at the mercy of the Sentinel just as an ordinary person would be, with no defense. So he's acting to save himself and the others, of course, who are also in danger. So I feel that it's a legitimate thing to do here. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is taking a risk, as he says, because he doesn't know what it's going to do to Ashley.
It could cause
her problems, and we don't know. Actually, we don't know what the result is here. He seems to have succeeded, he thinks, and she's sort of collapsing. But we don't see any more after this until maybe the next issue. So right now we don't know what the effect on her is.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, going back to what you said about Trask, the difference between him, though, and Professor X is, although Professor X can do this, he doesn't do it willy-nilly to everybody. He usually has a reason for doing it, whereas Trask is just like, oh, you know, all mutants are bad, you know, and a threat to us, so we've got to stop them all somehow. We've got to either contain them, take their powers away, or destroy them. Yeah. So they're looking at it from a little bit of a different angle. I know it can be seen as contentious, but...
Yeah, something for folks to think about.
Yeah.
Different question. So that ends the Illinois story for now.
Keying in on
that scene.
Yeah. Now, when we return to the circus again, as we do on the next page, and they're still fighting there, and Cyclops is blasting heads off clowns, so I hope they're not real people.
I hope so too, yeah.
He's blowing their heads up. But this is where I wasn't sure whether this crowd was an illusion or not, because Cyclops thinks to himself, is this crowd real or not? And if so, how do they see me?
Yeah.
And for just that one panel, as you can see, it shows you how the crowd sees Cyclops.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like this strange, kind of weird clown dressed in an X-Men onesie.
Yeah.
And he's just got one big eye in the middle of a white head. And it looks really weird. And so I thought, so is there a crowd that sees Cyclops as this like funny little creature?
Yeah.
Or is that just for the readers? Kind of effect, you know.
Yeah.
This is how the crowd is seeing him, even though the crowd is not real either.
Crowd isn't real, yeah.
It's part of the illusion, but the crowd is an illusion, but they are being illuded as to what Cyclops looks like.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting, yeah.
And the battle continues a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
On the one page, the page after that, there's Angel flying up, and it looks like Captain Caveman down there with the cowboy hat on, smoking a Popeye pipe.
Where are we?
We are on the page where Angel is battling clowns without heads.
Yeah.
It's the next.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's the next page. Right, got you.
It's over, yeah.
And most of the clowns are headless, but yes, I see. Yeah, the captain with like a Yosemite hat on.
The Yosemite hat, a Popeye.
And a pipe.
Yeah.
And big feet.
A little fun.
Character. Yeah, he's a Captain Caveman type hairy body with hands and feet. Got it. Yeah.
And then we get to Marvel Girl. So we know that wasn't Marvel Girl earlier because she's still locked up in her little room.
That's right.
And she's able to undo the lock telekinetically, only to be running into Mr.
Stephen Kruger. Yeah. He just comes creeping around the corner. Where's he been?
Yes.
Since they paid him off with fake money. Yeah.
Yeah. And how did he find them?
Yeah.
So not very good. And that even does not have any kind of a title box saying, you know, what's going on. We just flip the page and we're back in the X-Mansion.
That's right. The guys have arrived back from the Savage Land and they find the scorched carpet.
From the battle with the Fantastic Four.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
As you're going in, that's of course something you would see, and it's a nice way to move the story along and kind of touch base on previous issues worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they find Cerebro is working, and it's found a signal coming from the Himalayas.
Oh, setting up something else.
Yeah, I'm going to say, is this the start of yet another subplot? and then, of course, finally...
another subplot.
Long Island and Catherine Worthington, who I assume is the mother of Angel.
Angel's mother, yes.
Yeah. Talking to her...
Brother-in-law,
yeah. But they're talking about getting married.
Boom. So...
And that's where it ends.
And not just talking about it, as you see the final panel, the stage has been set.
That's true. Out in the garden, there's all the marquees and things set up ready for a wedding, it would appear.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, looking at the top panel, now I failed to do this. Maybe you thought of it. Did you think where this mansion might be in television history?
No, I didn't. No, that never crossed my mind at all. It's not Brian's house, is it? No.
It definitely could be Brian's house.
Is it on El Capitan Street? No, is it supposed to be like, obviously.
Well, I don't know if it's supposed to be, but he has a habit of doing that. Remember, Gene's parents were the Bewitched House.
The
apartment was the friend's apartment.
I can't think of any other mansions that are coming to my mind from TV, though, that look quite like this.
But that can be something. I'll look that. I will look for that.
Oh, you haven't got one in mind then?
Well, I thought I do. It kind of looks to me like it might be from Dark Shadows.
Which I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay.
What's that?
Dark Shadows was a soap opera serial.
Right.
Like EastEnders or Coronation.
Oh, okay. No, I never heard of it.
It took place in the 60s to the early 70s, but it was a vampire-based soap opera. It was a regular soap opera at the beginning, and then a new creator came on and he introduced the vampire and it
turned it into a vampire.
Classic with witches and vampires and hunting the vampires and ghosts and everything. And it was it still is a cult classic.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know about that because I'm going to say the only other mansion that was springing to my mind, but it doesn't look anything like this one really, is Lady Penelope's from Thunderbirds. But as I say, it doesn't look like that. So
that would be funny if it was Lady Penelope's. So I'm looking at the manor house. I just pulled it up on screen, and there's some similarities, but there's some turrets missing. So I don't know. I'm gonna try to do a reverse image and see if maybe I can't come up with something because he may have based it on. And that mansion is called Collinwood. So he may have based it on something, maybe not, but it's just
Burn might do these things. I mean, I had a similar when I saw the title of this issue, Bread and Circuses, and of course we know about Burn's love of Star Trek, the original series, and I thought, now then, has he been really clever here and use this title for this issue? Because if this issue had have run in the original time run of the X-Men, would it have coincided with the showing of that issue on TV? So I looked into when that episode of Star Trek aired, but the two dates don't correspond, so it's not that. But it could have been. Because the Star Trek episode aired in March of 1968, but the X-Men original run went into 1970 before they stopped. So no connection there.
Star Trek was running in reruns into the 70s, so maybe it was on the on a repeat. It could have coincided with it that way.
Right, yeah, but it didn't connect with the original.
Yeah.
So, but sure. I just thought, yeah, okay. I'll check that because you never know. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. So, well, that will wrap this up and take us up to the next episode, next issue. Yeah, issue 14. So, I'll put that away later. Let me get number 14 here in my hand. So, issue X-Men Hidden Years 14. Cover data, January 2001. Release date, November 1st, 2000. And the only other book by Byrne at that time that I could find was Marvel, The Lost Generation, number 2. This is the second to the last issue of that maxi or mini series. I don't know if that was if a 12 issue is a mini series or a maxi or what anymore. But
I think they describe that as a maxi, don't they? Yeah, I'm not 100% on that, but
that was the almost the next to the last issue of that. Mm-hmm. And the writer, penciler, and letterer is John Byrne. The inker is Tom Palmer, colorist Gregory Wright, editor Jason Liebig, and editor-in-chief Joe Quesada. So I guess he assumed the role from Bob Harris. Cover was by John Byrne, and I'm assuming that means he did it all, coloring, inking, and all that stuff. And there's an interesting little blurb on there. It says, John Byrne, MM, so 2000, with a grateful tip of the hat to Neil Adams, circa 69.
Yes. Which I just assumed that obviously there's a cover by Neil Adams somewhere, which is similar in, I don't know, structure, if you like, to this one, to this. I did have a look at the covers he did when he was doing X-Men. You know, Neil Adams. And one of them has a similar kind of setup with regards to where people are, although it's not exactly the same. That's X-Men, I think it's 63.
Okay.
As I say, it's not exactly the same, but it's similar. I'm wondering if it's that that he's tipping the hat to here with this cover.
All right, yeah. I don't know. Could be that cover. Who knows? we'll have to maybe do another reverse image or see. It would be interesting. Or maybe it was just sort of a style that he felt like, you know, the villain at the front, you know, and the X-Men there cowering, and it's hard to tell. So it'd be interesting. Yeah. You know what? It's too bad Brian's not here. Brian would probably know that off the top of his head.
But as I say, I mean, if you get chance to, if you can get a look at that issue 63 of the original X-Men run, you'll see what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually Magneto on that cover.
Yeah, it actually is. I'm looking at it now. Yeah, you're right. That is pretty, you know, a very similar design. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm wondering if it's that one or not. Yeah,
possibly. Okay, that is interesting, though. Those little tidbits he puts into it with us.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall I get into the recap here?
The synopsis, yeah.
The synopsis. So, after a split page recap of the three stories, showing us, you know, the Bobby, Havoc, and Polaris, or Lorna, she doesn't have her code name yet, in the computer room, Beast, Professor X, Ashley, and her mom there, right after Ashley has been stilled, as they would say on the ring, Wheel of Time series, and then a large panel showing the main story, which is the Angel and Cyclops battling the X-Men, and then a small insert with Marvel Girl. So after that little one-page recap, catching everybody up, because this was a monthly at the time, and you had to wait 30 days, so you might have forgotten. Then we get right into the circus battle, right heavily. So we're even going to delay the ending of the last issue where we had this big dramatic moment of reveal of Warren's mother possibly getting married. Oh, I was just going right into the book. I got to do my synopsis. I was turning pages as though we were talking about it. So after the recap, we open to Angel, Cyclops, and Candy in battle with the circus group. Illusions creatively provided by Mastermind with Blob and Eunice nearby. When Mr. Krueger shows up with an unconscious Marvel Girl and his posse. Switch to Dunphy, Illinois. The police arrive at the estate of the Martin family to investigate the commotion and reports of a giant robot where Professor X has eliminated the danger posed by the young mutant Ashley Martin. Professor comes up with a story regarding the Sentinel, saying that it must have crash-landed as he and his partner, Mr. McCoy, were investigating, but does not mention anything about Ashley being a mutant herself. Meanwhile, at Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, Iceman Havoc and Lorna are in the dark about what happened in the house. Looking at the computer equipment, Bobby checks out Cerebro, which shows a new mutant single in the Himalayas, which we saw last week, last issue. But it's also registered that Cyclops, Marvel Girl, and Angel are currently in Florida. Havoc immediately wants to go there, but first, Iceman wants to search the whole school to make sure everything is secure. Havoc thinks that's a good idea, actually, and they go about searching the house. Meanwhile, again, in Florida, Stefan Krueger and his posse confront the Blob, Mastermind, and Eunice after he found out that the money they gave him for handing over the X-Men was just an illusion crafted by Mastermind. Krueger's power can shut down the power of his opponents, but this also destroys the illusion that Mastermind was currently using on Cyclops, Angel, and Candy. Krueger doesn't fear them, but he does not know that Candy is not a mutant, and she knocks him unconscious with a swift kick as she wheels in on a nice rope ladder. Krueger's followers are protesting at the putting out Krueger, but Jean explains to them that he is not the good man they see in him, making them see that he doesn't really care about them either, that he was just using them as he uses others, and they hesitantly agree and decide to back off, but not before handing over the injured Avia to the X-Men. After the police take away the evil mutants, the X-Men, Candy, and Avia fly back to Salem, New York. Finally, Candy has a chance to talk to Angel, as we've been waiting for, what, 6 issues now?
At least, yeah.
And she explains that his mother plans to marry his uncle Bertram Worthington. Warren is in shock because not only is his uncle a villain that he and Candy had recently faced, see Kazar, but also that he thought Bertram was dead. At the school, all the X-Men reunite, and only Professor X is missing because he stayed in Illinois with Ashley and her mother. Warren decides to visit his mother, but he only wants Candy and the original X-Men to accompany him to Long Island. During the flight, Angel explains further what happened between him and his uncle, who calls himself the Dazzler. No, folks, not that Dazzler. And he went from smuggling diamonds to planning his world domination while killing his brother in the process as well. In their final showdown, over in the skies, both Bertram and Candy were falling to their deaths, and Angel decided to save Candy. Now he regrets never checking if his uncle really died. When the X-Men and Candy arrive at the Worthington estate, the wedding preparations are in full swing. They are greeted first by Dr. Stewart, a confidant of the family who delivered Warren as a baby and knows about his wings. Warren would like to directly confront his uncle, but Dr. Stewart tells him that his mother continues to be very fragile, and exposing Bertram as a fraud who killed her husband could lead to her death.
And that's that.
And that's that. Yes. Ooh. Next issue. Death Be Not Proud.
ominous
somber moment.
So we've
what did we've you think of that?
Very good. We've finally wrapped up two of the ongoing plots.
Yes,
to get, yeah, to get straight into another one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What'd you think of the cover?
The cover. Yeah, it's not one of my favorites. I don't know whether it's because of the, probably because of the coloring. Yeah. And also, I don't know, something about the way he's drawn everyone. A little bit different to usual. Unless, I think, well, as it suggests, he's probably going for a kind of old Neil Adams-y kind of look to the figures. It's not as jump out at you as let's say the previous cover or some of the others we've had already. I think that's what it is. It wouldn't necessarily stand out to me on like the rack, if you like, or the shelf.
Yeah.
In the way that the others would. Again, I think it's because of the colouring.
Or lack of it, actually.
Yeah, that's it. I'm going to say it's very mono toned.
Yeah.
So it's only the actual title, X-Men, in bright red, you know, and bedazzled at the bottom, that makes it stand out.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I'm not that impressed with the cover either. Yeah. I mean, it's a well-done cover, but...
Yeah.
And maybe it's because now that I know what's inside, I'm like, and I don't think a cover always has to reflect what's inside, but I'm like, I don't know. I mean, this wasn't a primary story. So although it wants to be a primary, I don't think that this is a image to solicit for a story that's within.
Yeah, because it's kind of, I mean, like you say, we don't see this image as such inside the comic, but we do see the same thing.
Yes,
but instead of like on the cover, they're all dressed in their costumes, including the villain. Whereas inside, when he actually does release his light for a few seconds, they're all dressed in civvies.
Yeah,
so it's not quite as spectacular, but. So, I mean, it does happen, but in a different way. Yeah. And not that dangerous, because he suddenly has to switch off his light again, you know, because he doesn't want to give himself away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's connected, but yeah, it's not what we're going to get inside.
Yeah.
And also, of course, because this is the first time we've seen this guy in his costume, when you look at the cover, it's like, who's that?
Yeah.
You know,
he's really relying on you knowing about the story in Kazar.
Which I didn't.
I didn't either. I was kind of surprised.
I had no idea, because as we're reading through his kind of retelling of the story, and I thought, when did this happen?
Yeah, exactly.
And it does just say, somewhere, a little note about Kazar. I don't think it even gives an issue number, though, does it?
I don't recall. We'll have to see when we get to it.
Mm.
Did you find the number? We're looking for 80 this time.
Yeah. Did you find it?
I did, too, or I found a number.
Yeah.
his left boot?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not easy to find. It took me a while, if I remember rightly. I studied this several times, and I was like, I'm not sure where it is. And then eventually, I just happened to see, and I thought, what's that?
Yeah.
When I kind of closed in on it, there you go. It's the 8/0. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's very dark in there with the colors.
So small. Yeah, so small. Yeah, it's almost like it just looks like his ankle wrinkle on his boot.
Yeah. So that was a good disguise.
Yes, but yeah, there it is. Yeah, left boot. Well done.
So we open up to a split page.
Yeah.
Four different images to recap all of the stories, which is really, really well done. Basically tells you what you need to know to start the story.
It does, although it's a bit of an anticlimax, though, isn't it? Because we're so used to seeing a splash page.
Yeah.
When we opened the comic, when I opened this, I sort of went, what's all this then? And then I realized, well, yeah, it's showing us where we were at the end of last issue, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, that's the recap done on one page. But I expected maybe when I turned to page 2 and 3, we might get a double spread or something like that, but we don't.
Wouldn't that have been nice?
Yeah, because he's done that before with other titles. You know, you open it up and page 2 and 3 has been a fabulous double spread, but not to be in this case.
Yeah, so we're continuing on with the battle with the circus, or the illusion circus.
He just actually repeats himself a bit on these two pages as well, because Angel flies Candy up to that safe, platform. Now, he did that in the previous issue. He actually took her up there and left her for safety. So that's like a redrawing of the same thing happening again.
Yeah.
And then Kruger, of course, coming in with his freak show.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the villains, it shows you the villain's reaction to Kruger appearing this time.
Let's get out of here,
But then, as you say, everything, the illusion fades away because Kruger has that effect on all the mutants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he knows he's been cheated out of his money.
He's pretty upset.
And then, though, we're back to Illinois where we finally found out, did Professor X kind of like scramble Ashley's brain for good or what's happened? Yeah.
Well, it kind of looks like not, but we're not sure.
Yeah, it's a bit like a similar thing to what happened to Franklin when they first kind of depowered him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just becomes like an ordinary child again, saying what happened. Yep.
And of course, the police show up, and unfortunately, we didn't do any Jedi mind control. These are not the Sentinels you're looking for. He just was like, well, I'm not even going to bother hiding them. And the Sentinel was there. He cried.
But that was, the guy who, one of the policemen, says that he remembers Professor X from when Trask first introduced his Sentinels.
Yeah.
So, which is good, because then the professor uses that information to spin his story about how this Sentinel must have just come along and crashed here.
Mm-hmm. Which is plausible, and it works well, and no one has to be the wiser. And
that's it. And it saves them from being arrested as well.
Yeah, fortunately, Hank is not in costume or anything, so...
So they get away with that.
And then time for a little quick interlude. This is where Bobby and Havoc and Lorna decide to, what's their next step? Do they go find the mutant in Himalayas, or do they go and find Cyclops, or do they go and help the professor? What should they do?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, we've got a burned rug. What's going on here?
And I like the way that Havoc states that the Cerebro has found Scott and Jean and Warren, and they're in Florida. So just in case we didn't know, because we didn't really know where they were exactly with this circus business. And we now know they are in the U.S. They're in Florida.
And quick back to the circus, and very cognizant here, looking at this bottom panel, Cyclops' visor is very old school.
Mm.
Definitely not the Cochrane or the later burn version of the
one. Oh, no, it's the
He's
old.
He's keeping it quite period.
Yeah. It seems to be, on that very bottom panel, it seems to be quite big as well. It's kind of sticking out further than it usually looks as if it does, yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is.
It's definitely 3D-ish, and it's kind of like, I don't know, it seems to have been lengthened.
Definitely indeed.
And then, of course, I like the next page where Kruger, Blob's kind of having a go at him. And Kruger just says, well, you know, you don't bother me, because you might be Blob with the power to everybody else, but to me, you're just another fat man.
Yeah.
And pushes him over.
Obviously, he has some other power that, because Blob is not a small man. So
I doubt if he'd be able to just push him normally. Yeah. He must have some kind of repelling effect.
Or can he take someone's power and kind of minorly use it or something? That's interesting. Because, I don't know how he would be able to manage pushing over Blob.
Blob, yeah. And then all the other mutants, of course, have lost their power, so everybody's jumping on Eunice because he's Eunice the touchable now.
Yeah, he definitely is touchable.
And these freaks are like all over him. Yeah.
And now we're revealed.
Oh, and the clowns and things were just like ordinary.
Yeah. You know, in that bottom page there, there must be some sort of an audience because if you look at behind Angel, there are faces in them. So there is some sort of an audience.
Yeah.
There. I thought there might not have been, looks like there was some sort of an audience.
Unless it's just a painting on a wall.
Because
we don't seem to see them in any detail, do we?
No, I think it's just he doesn't want to. It is showing that there was an audience of some sort. Yeah, well, Krueger is going to try to use Jean, Marvel Girl, for some nefarious purposes. I think he probably thinks he can manipulate her telepathy or whatever. She doesn't look very good there. But then Candy to the rescue.
Yeah, I was going to say, in swings Candy doing her impression of Errol Flynn or something from some sort of swashbuckling.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good indeed.
Film and smacks him in the head, and takes him out. That were good. I like that.
But a kind of a swift resolution. I think maybe Byrne was done with the story too. He's like, I just need to wrap
it up. Yeah, he's wrapping up this one. Yeah, nicely.
Yeah. On the next page, as Jean's talking to them, the middle panel, the big lady, she kind of reminds me of Big Bertha from Great Lakes Avengers. Yeah. If this is really her or...
No, I don't think it is, but it's that look, isn't it? The big fat lady. Yeah, she's just short of a beard, really. She'd be the bearded lady.
Wise words, and they're off. Of course, they got to deal with the police and figure out what's going to happen when they wake up, because
they can't do a lot with the Blob and Eunice when they wake up.
Yeah. And with Mastermind actually still awake, who knows if they'll be able to actually keep him.
Yeah, so Cyclops tells him to get the Avengers or the FF in to deal with Blob and Eunice.
And they have their ship or their plane, which that's very handy on board that big ship.
They kept their plane. Yeah.
And then they're on their way back to...
They get that back, yeah.
On their way back,
Candy gets a bit upset by the way that Avia cuddles up to Angel when she meets him again.
Yeah. got some explaining to do, Warren.
Yeah.
Not right now.
Yeah.
Not right now.
And then off they go.
So we regroup. Everyone's together now except for the professor, which is fine. Got the whole team back. We're at status quo, status ground zero here.
Ready to set off once more. They're not even gonna have a coffee by the looks of it. We got to get over to
change our clothes and go
Worthington's place because there's a marriage to stop. Yeah, maybe
indeed. So and then while on the plane, of course, this is where we'll get the recap from Warren's story with the Dazzler.
And just before that, though, Cyclops questions Jean about how she convinced Krueger's freak guys to accept. He says, did you use a little telepathic nudge?
Mm-hmm.
To which she says, yes, basically. It seemed like
as if it was subconscious or not something on her full mind.
It seemed like the way Professor X might have done it.
And again, a little tie-in again, because remember when she used that nudge in X-Men 130 to get Kitty Pryde's parents to overcome their anger about shop and what happened to my daughter, and she kind of just made things change, and Scott called her out on it and said, hey, did you do something? And she's like, yes, I didn't think it would hurt. He goes, well, that something that you and the professor used to say was something you would never do. You know, you were against that, but she didn't see the harm in it there. So again, it's a nice little kind of a reconnection of that, like we saw last issue. And then, now we get the backstory. Now we figure out what happened to Warren's dad and who his uncle is.
Yeah, he was actually a bad guy with a small army by the looks of it. There's some other guys in costume attacking Angel there.
Yeah, well, a bad guy, a villain that does have to have his posse, right?
Yeah, his goons, yeah.
So I'm trying to find where it mentions Kazar, but
I'm beginning to think I didn't read it in the comic. I think it might have been something on the wiki when I was reading the synopsis.
Yep.
You know how they have those
notes
sometimes about connections to other issues.
Yeah.
I think that's where I probably saw it.
Probably me too, yeah.
And then you said he was carrying both of them, and then but the villain hit Angel, so he dropped them both, and then of course he could only save one. Well, I mean, which one would you go for?
Right.
You're going to catch Candy on it, aren't you?
Going to catch Candy for sure.
Yeah.
We meet Dr. Stewart, and he knows who the X-Men are, obviously.
Yeah, well, or he's put two and two together.
Definitely has.
I was a bit wary of this doctor as well, actually, at this stage. I mean, I know he seems like the kind family doctor, but he seems to know too much.
But so did Cameron Hodges when he was working with the X Factor.
He seems to know too much,
and
not be bothered by the fact that Bertram is this bad guy. But
yeah, that seems a little strange, and he's willing to let Warren's mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marry this evil man.
Yeah. Simply because, to upset her would kill her, maybe.
Yeah, and there's got to be a way to break that news to her that wouldn't kill her.
Yeah.
Because you know that this guy is up to no good. He's just going to probably end up killing her himself and assuming control of the Worthington fortune.
I mean, if you ask me right now, because I can't remember what comes next.
I can't either, and I haven't read ahead.
I would think that, this doctor's maybe is in with the bad guy. He's either going to give him money or a fortune or something if he plays along with it. Yeah,
seems like it.
We'll see.
We shall see. Yeah. And then over the page, we get the scene from the cover. Basically,
the bad guy reveals himself because they know who he is and they're threatening him. Yeah, Warren wants to sock him now. Yeah, they have to hold Warren off.
Hold him back.
So he just gives them a flash of his dazzler power.
Yeah. Now at this point, the X-Men are probably 1920. Are they out of their teens yet?
I don't know. They must be getting close. Yeah. Beast was the oldest. Yeah. Hank McCoy was the oldest, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So he might.
Always the youngest.
Yeah. I think the Beast is coming up to being 20.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Bobby's supposedly the youngest.
Yeah. All right. So we're just. So it's a lot for, a teenagers to be dealing with. So say Warren's 18 or 19, maybe 17, 18. It's a lot to deal with, but, they do act like a little bit older than that, but that's okay. And then in comes Mom, and Dazzler turns off his power,
And to me, his mother, the way that Burns kind of drawing her, she looks like she's kind of in a trance or she's under somebody's power.
She does seem like she's been drugged or something. Like indeed.
A bit vacant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dazzler, I'm sure he probably has a way to be doing that with her. So, and then we get the reveal. Oh, in her delicate condition, that would most certainly kill her.
Yeah. So he says, he's suggesting that they let the marriage go ahead. For the sake of her.
That brings us up to there.
Two good issues.
Any last thoughts on them?
Yeah, I, As I said before, I'm enjoying rereading these, because especially now we've got onto the teens. I haven't really looked at most of these since I originally read them.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Which is quite a while ago now. 25 years or
almost
so.
25 years, yeah. Definitely for me, I sort of have vague moments of memories of different things, but it's almost like reading them all over again. So
yeah, that's nice. So I'm enjoying them again, definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I did read one of the letters in one of the books. I think it was in issue 14. The letter writer was like, "Oh, I've caught these errors. You know, there were no handhelds in the 60s, and they're, you know, the hairstyles should be."
Oh yeah. Funny. I read that one last night as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the response was basically that, well, although they take place after the cancellation, that in between period, these aren't taking place in the 60s. They're taking place in Marvel time, sliding scale, which is roughly six years earlier. So it's going to be updated to the 90s, you know, things. So hairstyles, clothing, technology, that kind of stuff. So, and I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm going to say, it's a fair point, but.
But I like that the reader was paying attention, you know, and like, oh, you know, hey, what about this? You know, like.
Yeah. So. I mean, I'm not always big on them getting the fashions right and stuff like that because, sometimes I don't like the look of some of the fashions that were of a particular time. Yeah. So it's like, ooh, you know, I'd rather you just draw them like you always did. Yeah, because they've said that about the Fantastic Four issues that Byrne did, and because he always tried to keep up to date with the like hairstyles and fashions.
Well, they all kind of did. Cochran was really big on fashion as well.
Yeah, which looked okay at the time when they were in.
Yeah.
But when you look at some of them now, it really dates it.
Should conclude us for now. X-Men heading years 13 and 14.
Yep.
Any announcements?
Where can they find us? The listeners find us? Well, the best place is to find us on our Third Degree Burn Facebook page.
Yes, that is the best place.
You can also send us an email giving us your thoughts on this run of the comic or what you thought of it yourself.
And if you happen to know that mansion from last issue.
Yeah, if you recognize the mansion.
The Worthington Mansion. If you can give us some hints, that'd be great to hear.
And so you can write an email at...
gottogetburned@gmail.com.
gmail.com, yeah.
And that's Byrned, B-Y-R-N-E-D.
I enjoyed that, those two couple of issues, and we'll wait and see what's going to happen to the X-Men next.
Thanks, Nigel.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's tutufreaks.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.